Welcome to the AI Policy Podcast, a podcast by the Wadhwani Center for AI and Advanced Technologies at CSIS. I'm Gregory C. Allen.
And I'm Andrew Schwartz.
Join us as we dive into the world of AI policy, where we'll discuss the implications of this transformative technology for national security, geopolitics, and global governance.
Greg, everything seems to be about Elon Musk these days. So why don't we start off by talking about him? Last Friday, Elon Musk announced he was suing OpenAI on the grounds that the company had deviated from its original mission to be a nonprofit laboratory for cutting-edge AI technology. But before we get into the lawsuit itself, can you give us a brief backstory on Musk and OpenAI and why we're even talking about this?
Sure. So Elon Musk is, you know, best known as the founder, really, of SpaceX and Tesla, two really impressive California-based technology companies. But he also was part of the founding story of OpenAI and provided some of the early money to OpenAI back when it was a nonprofit. This is in the 2015 timeframe. In terms of his own, you know, description of his role in the story, he says that he was personally responsible for recruiting some of the most impressive AI talent in the world to OpenAI. And especially in the early days, competition for the best talent really was the source of competitive advantage.
So is that true? Did he do that?
According to his own claim.
This is his claim.
You know, he recruited Ilya Sutskever, who was on the board when the board fired Sam Altman at OpenAI, of note.
Okay.
And Ilya Sutskever is undisputedly, you know, one of the most impressive researchers in AI that we've had in the past 20 years. And he was originally going to go to DeepMind. Elon claims that he persuaded him to come to OpenAI. And then the company was sort of off to the races, is the Elon version of the story. But Elon exited OpenAI. He left the board in 2018, saying that he wanted to focus on Tesla, which also has a big AI division related to autonomous driving and the associated AI technologies that you need to enable that. And it said, you know, OpenAI in its blog post, this will eliminate a potential future conflict for Elon. So Musk has had no formal role in OpenAI for many years now.
Okay, so if he's been out for a while, why is he now filing this lawsuit? And what's this lawsuit about?
So he's making a ton of claims in this lawsuit, and a lot of the claims are now public, as is some of OpenAI's responses to those claims. But he says that OpenAI is in breach of contract and is violating fiduciary duty, as well as having unfair business practices. So he's throwing kind of the kitchen sink legally. But his basic argument is that OpenAI, when he was pumping money into it, when he was on the board, was supposed to be a nonprofit focused on developing advanced AI to benefit humanity and not pursue profits. And now OpenAI has a famously complicated legal structure with a lot of different companies, some of which exist as nonprofits, some of which exist as for-profits, some of which, you know, have different responsibilities and ownerships of the overall pie. And the point here is that Elon Musk is saying, this isn't what I, you know, signed up to create. This isn't what I paid for. And you are now in breach of various U.S. laws and also various duties that you had to me and other folks.
It sounds like a little bit of crybaby here. What's the merit on of his case? Is he likely to win, or is this just something that's going to be dragged through the courts?
Well, I think there's sort of two really important questions that any judge would have to answer when they're evaluating Elon Musk's claims. Number one is the legal concept of standing, which is this person actually a harmed entity who is allowed to bring a suit, right? Because if you were to steal something from your neighbor, and I, somebody who lives in a totally different neighborhood and has nothing to do with your neighbor or the stolen item, I can't sue you for stealing from your neighbor. Only your neighbor could sue, perhaps. And the question here is, if Musk left the board of OpenAI in 2018, and if many of those suits were not launched in 2018, does Musk actually still have legal standing in order to bring this suit? And I think this is, if the suit does fall apart, it may very well fall apart on this question of legal standing.
All right, Greg, so what's your sense of this? Is this just sport for Elon Musk here, or is he really trying to achieve something?
Well, I think amongst the rich billionaires of the world, the court system, you don't have to necessarily be confident that you're going to win the lawsuit to feel like it is in your best interests to launch the lawsuit.
How so?
Well, Elon Musk is a competitor of OpenAI in many ways, right? Twitter, which Elon Musk owns, now it's X, I suppose I should say, has its own large language model-based AI system called Grok that is, at least in Musk's marketing, supposed to compete head-to-head with OpenAI ChatGPT. And then also Tesla has a major AI division. And while OpenAI is mostly focused on text-based systems and Tesla is mostly focused on vision and image-based systems, you know, the reality is they're competing for talent, they're competing for all sorts of different things. And so the question here is, you know, these are issues that Musk, by launching this lawsuit, has put into the public discourse, right? He has generated a bunch of media attention discussing these topics.
We're talking about it.
We're talking about it right now. And so he may feel that even if he loses the lawsuit, he may have sort of raised these issues and these questions about OpenAI in the public consciousness, and that might be enough to pay his lawyer's fees.
Okay. Well, he's actually not the only source of OpenAI's legal issues. Back in December, the New York Times filed a lawsuit against OpenAI and Microsoft for alleged copyright infringement. Last week, OpenAI moved to dismiss, alleging the New York Times paid someone to hack OpenAI's products. First, Greg, can you give us a recap of the lawsuit so far and why it was initially filed by the Times?
So this lawsuit is actually still relatively recent. It dates back to December 27th, 2023. And the New York Times was the first major media organization to sue OpenAI. And the basic claim here is that, one, New York Times still owns the copyright to the text of all the New York Times articles.
That's and OpenAI is sucking everything up for the New York Times for free is their claim.
That's right? The claim, right? Okay. And they're not compensating them for the use of that data. The second thing is the use of OpenAI of New York Times' data does not constitute fair use in the traditional copyright sense of that legal term. So the part of this is
they're not using 5 or 10 words, they're using 500 words, is that what?
Right. So if I write a CSIS article here, I can quote from the New York Times. I think our own internal standard is you shouldn't quote more than 50 words.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we're going to analyze the report in those 50 words. New York Times claims that by putting in just the first sentence of a New York Times article, you can get ChatGPT to spit out the remaining 1,000, 2,000, whatever 1,000 words. And that is basically serving up New York Times content in a way that OpenAI is being compensated by its users who are paying OpenAI for this service. So OpenAI is getting paid for New York Times content. New York Times is not getting paid for that content by OpenAI is the claim. So this is fundamentally about intellectual property and how it relates to the new technology of large language models. And we've sort of seen a version of this in the past. The Google search engine also serves up other people's content. And Google has now developed all these sort of different rules of the road for how to responsibly deal with the content that they serve up to their users. Just to give you one example, Google used to favor in search results people who didn't have a paywall for their content. So the New York Times hated this because they would do, you know, all the reporting for an article, you know, to find out some kind of newsworthy scoop. And then the news aggregator like the Huffington Post, which actually did know original journalism to, you know, find out that story.
Right. They're saying first reported in the New York Times.
Exactly. Yeah. So they're acknowledging it, but they're actually extracting a lot of the economic value of just commenting on the New York Times story. And Google was assisting them on that. Google has sort of changed its practices since. They actually, into the algorithm that serves up news results, make a deliberate effort to know who did the original journalism on any given story and to favor that in terms of serving up results. But even when they serve up results, they're serving up the headline, a tiny thumbnail image, and maybe the first two lines of the article.
Right, because you have to, let's face it, good journalism is expensive.
Oh, yeah.
And it costs the New York Times and other outlets, Wall Street Journal is another great example of this, Financial Times, Washington Post, it costs them a lot to actually report what they're reporting on. So they're saying, just like Google ripped us all off back in the day and kind of ruined journalism for a while, especially local journalism, this is the new frontier.
Right. And so OpenAI's claim is that this outcome that the New York Times is claiming occurred is not something that could be generated in the normal course of user interactions with the ChatGPT system, but rather that more or less somehow the New York Times has effectively hacked the system and had a very unusual, non-standard interaction that is not realistic in terms of, you know, how users are actually using ChatGPT. It appears like this is something that's going to be decided in court, not by, you know, somebody here. But I do think it's also worth pointing out that the New York Times is no longer alone. Other outlets are now suing OpenAI on the same grounds.
Who else has joined the lawsuit? Is it the Post and
Raw Story, Alternet, The Intercept? You know, all of them are now suing OpenAI in a similar New York federal court on similar grounds. So this is an argument that is, at least in the court system, gaining momentum. For their part, Microsoft and OpenAI, they basically respond, look, the technology works the way technology works. Like, this is an approach that can generate high-performing AI systems. And whatever the courts decide, they should not make it illegal to make high-performing AI systems if we're thinking that these high-performance AI systems have a really important role to play in the future of economy. So they're basically saying, don't ban innovation prematurely. Let's try and figure out some kind of solution where the media ecosystem and the journalism ecosystem and the AI ecosystem can work together.
Where they can really coexist and everybody can benefit, I would think.
Yeah, that's what they hope. That's what they want. You know, Google was sued, and Google sort of came up with these internal best practices. Perhaps, you know, that could be one outcome here.
In the meantime, OpenAI's move to throw the lawsuit out. Do you think that this lawsuit is likely to succeed? It feels to me like the Times has some recourse here.
So I don't claim to know the legal specifics on what is actually likely to win in court, but throw the lawsuit out is not what most of the lawyers are saying. Now, granted, you know, these are lawyers who are being interviewed by journalists in order to comment on what they think are the likely outcomes. So maybe the journalists are finding the lawyers who agree, you know, with the preferred journalism opinion. I'm making a joke here, but it seems to me that, you know, it being thrown out is probably not the expected outcome.
All right, so let's back up for a minute, because I want to talk to you a little bit about why fair use is so important to these large language models. And you mentioned, you know, what OpenAI is saying in this case is we don't want to stifle innovation. We want to be able to keep moving this forward, and you're putting up speed bumps. We want to try to compensate you or figure something out, but still, we don't want speed bumps. So why is fair use so important to these models?
Well, you know, fair use is a legal standard that has been hugely impactful in the history of media, and especially in the era of the internet, where media can be copied and shared and broadcast really easily, really quickly to these sort of massive audiences. And so the fair use standard sort of is the mechanism for ensuring that the creators of content, of intellectual property, of journalism, still have a financial incentive to create. Because if you make it impossible to make a living as a journalist, there won't be very many journalists anymore, and society benefits from the existence of journalists. And the same is true of other kinds of intellectual property, you know, whether it's Hollywood movies or podcasts or anything else. All of this is now, you know, existing in some way in relation to the AI ecosystem. For Apple Podcasts, for example, now most podcasts are by default, AI is generating automatic transcripts for Apple Podcasts.
And you see this on Spotify too,
exactly.
Where even with song lyrics.
Right.
All of a sudden I'm looking at my Spotify and lyrics are popping up.
And I don't know if AI is actually responsible for the song lyrics or if there's humans involved in that transaction. But in the case of podcasts, you know, now there is this whole world of transcripts which could conceivably be used as training data by Apple as they're thinking about their own AI systems. And so, you know, the folks who are generating content are really having to sort of assess what is the new normal for them in a media landscape where AI plays such a prominent role.
And they basically want to take everything that's not nailed down. They want more, more, more.
Well, there's certainly companies who want more, more, more. I'll say in the case of Google, I think they've sort of changed their own internal opinion about this topic. And what I mean by that is, Google really rides the open internet, the web, the World Wide Web that is available to everyone, as opposed to, say, the internet that exists behind the walled garden of Instagram or the walled garden of Facebook, and especially the encrypted walled garden that exists behind WhatsApp. You know, you can't find WhatsApp conversations in Google search results. And if you're a company like Google, your revenues are tied to what people can find on the open internet. And so if you take away all the incentive to put stuff on the open internet by extracting all the economic value, then there's not going to be a lot of stuff on the open internet. And that's harmful to Google. So I do think there is at least a possibility of there being some kind of equilibrium between the tech giants and the content providers. But right now, neither side seems happy with the current state of affairs.
Greg, I want to ask you about Microsoft now. Microsoft has invested around $13 billion in OpenAI, but just last week, Microsoft's president, Brad Smith, who's also a CSIS trustee, unveiled a multi-year partnership with French AI startup Mistral. Give me a sense of what we know about this deal and what are your biggest takeaways from Brad's announcement?
So there aren't a ton of details about this that are public. First, it's important to note that Mistral really looms large in the European consciousness about AI. It's a very young startup, but it's one that French President Emmanuel Macron has sort of personally thrown his weight behind as a potential European AI champion to compete with the major tech giants of the United States in particular. But Mistral is quite young, and Microsoft, in terms of what the role that they play in the AI ecosystem, they have homegrown AI capabilities, but in the case of their partnership with AI, they're principally an infrastructure provider. The big supercomputing data center where OpenAI is run was built and operated by Microsoft. And then they're also a touch point for the customer. You know, how can you experience the capabilities of OpenAI? You can use Microsoft's search engine Bing, which takes advantage of some of the same technology, or you can integrate it in Microsoft Office products. And so the nature of this partnership, what it looks like, is that one, you know, Mistral will provide commercial language models on Microsoft's cloud Azure computing platform, and they'll, alongside OpenAI, be available. And if you think about somebody like AWS, another major cloud computing provider, they're also trying to make multiple foundation models like GPT-4, like Anthropic's Claude, sort of available on their platform. And so Microsoft is investing in Mistral, although not in equity investments, just in sort of collaborative investments. And they're making Mistral AI capabilities available through their platforms.
Okay, so Microsoft has already faced regulatory scrutiny in the United States, Britain, and in the European Union from its investment into OpenAI. Do you see this partnership with Mistral prompting a similar response from regulatory bodies in the EU and the UK?
So it is definitely the case that there are folks in the European media landscape who are wondering if there was some kind of elaborate conspiracy, you know, here where Mistral was very prominent in the EU AI Act negotiations. But, you know, having spoken to these folks, I can recall when they talked about the fact that they, you know, hadn't yet had a meeting, you know, during the EU AI Act debate. So it's really hard for me to imagine that there was any kind of collaboration taking place when they really were not engaging in any way that I could tell substantively. I was personally also trying to get in touch with Mistral, and it's only like 50 employees. And as you can imagine, they're starting up a company. They have a lot of stuff they're trying to do. And so I don't think there's anything there. But it is definitely the case that some EU politicians have sort of raised the question.
All right, I want to end by moving in on some news in AI governance. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo announced in early February the establishment of a new AI Safety Institute consortium. The acronym is AISIC. It's a partnership of over 200 organizations, including OpenAI, Google, Anthropic, and Microsoft. Greg, what is Secretary Raimondo trying to do here, and what problems are this consortium created to solve?
Well, there's this large debate around AI safety and how can we actually ensure that AI models behave and perform in a way that is safe across an incredibly diverse set of use cases. And one thought here is that the practices, you know, both the technical practices and the process management practices around AI safety there's not a ton of vehicles right now where those best practices can diffuse across the entire AI industry. And so ASIC, which is actually a play on a different acronym that exists in the computer chip world, is intended to unite AI developers and users and academics and government industry researchers and civil society organizations, basically the kitchen sink of people who play in the AI policy world, and bring them together to share best practices, develop guidelines for things like red teaming or capability evaluations. So that's the idea, and it really is an important part of the Biden administration's AI executive order.
How does it fit into their vision for AI safety, and more broadly, how does it advance the agenda of President Biden's executive order on AI?
Yeah, I think one thing to think about here is measurement, which when it comes to regulation is surprisingly important. You know, just to use an analogy.
What do you mean by measurement?
Yeah, to use an analogy from the automotive world, you know, the EPA says that, you know, your cars cannot be sold unless they get such and such miles per gallon. And there is an official test, you know, that the EPA requires companies to run and submit their data to say what is a miles per gallon. Because you can imagine if a car company ran their miles per gallon test on the world's longest downhill slope, well, they're going to get a lot of miles per gallon, right? So there has to be an official standard for how miles per gallon is measured in a way that, you know, the regulator says this complies. Well, in the case of AI, a lot of these measurements don't exist yet. And so when the government says something like, we're going to regulate AI,
they don't even know what to start with.
Exactly. So the question is, you know, what are the standards, and then how are they going to be measured? And then how do we make that well known across the entire AI industry, which includes a big chunk of the American economy, the global economy. So the AI Safety Institute Consortium is supposed to support a lot of this work and helping develop these standards, helping develop these guidelines, helping share best practices, which will be useful for, you know, compulsory regulation or even voluntary self-regulation by the companies. This is important work that needs doing regardless of what approach the U.S. takes.
Greg, another fascinating conversation. We'll be back in a week or so to talk more about AI policy. You've given us an awful lot to think about here. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks, Andrew. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the AI Policy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And don't forget to visit our website, csis.org, for show notes and our research reports. See you next time.